This is All Things Considered on 90.1 WABE. I'm Dennis O'Hare. The housing recession has been slowly easing in Metro Atlanta, but if you're thinking this finally might be the time to buy a first home, can you afford it? The answer might very well be no, according to an analysis by CityLab.com, an urban planning website that was started by The Atlantic. Richard Florida is a co-founder and editor-at-large at CityLab. He's senior editor at The Atlantic as well, and he's also the director of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto and a global research professor at NYU. His analysis of city-by-city housing prices is on the CityLab website. Richard Florida, welcome. Good to have you.
It's great to be with you, Dennis.
Now, you looked at some inventory and sales numbers from Zillow, and you compared 32 cities, by my count anyway, for the percentages of houses in their markets that are less expensive. Atlanta had the third lowest percentage of what one might call affordable housing for poor and working class families among all 32 of those cities. Now, that might surprise someone who thinks, okay, oh, San Francisco, New York, they're unaffordable. What's going on with Atlanta?
Well, you know, Dennis, there's good news and there's bad news. In general, according to the Zillow data that we looked at the CityLab site that my team and I looked at, Atlanta, the home value index as calculated by Zillow, they calculate that based on homes that were sold and homes in the general area, was $149,000. So that's less than the U.S. average of nearly $175,000 and a whole lot less than San Francisco, where average housing prices are up almost to $700,000 or L.A., where they're over $500,000, or New York or Washington, when they're in the high to mid 300,000s. The bad news, however, is that when Zillow crunched the numbers into three categories, how much of your for sale inventory at the moment is affordable? How much of it is mid-tier, in other words, maybe for a middle-class family or a professional family? And how much of it is kind of expensive, you know, for really rich people to buy? Only about 21% of housing in the Atlanta market was affordable. I mean, only Dallas and Denver, again, two places that have relatively affordable housing, but given that they have affordable housing like Atlanta, I think a lot of that affordable housing has been sucked up. And again, both of those places have over 50% of their housing on the market in the expensive tier. What it may indicate, and, you know, this would be worth picking up in future analysis, is that, you know, in San Francisco or in New York or in Los Angeles, housing is more expensive, but wages are higher. Whereas in Atlanta, housing prices may be lower, but you know, the take-home pay of the working person, the working family, may be less. So, but the bottom line is that even though Atlanta's housing prices look good in general at $149,000 for those houses that sold recently, there's only less than one in five houses, roughly one in five houses on the market is in that affordable category.
And when you say affordable, explain exactly what you mean by that.
Well, Zillow is a little bit hazy on this. They basically characterized three tiers, affordable, mid-tier, and the expensive tier. And they adjust that by local housing market. So it's hard to say exactly what that amount is, but you know, one would think it's substantially less than the $149,000 average price.
Is this a passing thing just because of, say, trends in terms of housing inventory and all the regular market conditions that change day to day almost, or is this something that you see as a trend that will continue?
Well, the way I see things is that we are going through what I've termed a great reset in the housing market. You know, it's happening slowly but surely. I think you see it particularly in the hyper-expensive markets, the New Yorks, the San Franciscos, and the LAs, where people are going to have to get used to living in smaller homes and maybe living in a condominium as opposed to that big single-family house. The other thing you see is that, you know, you think of New York and Boston and LA and San Francisco as being very expensive, but they're also getting a lot of new construction. The old Rust Belt, the Detroits, the Clevelands, and so on, are not. And the Sun Belt centers, you know, and I don't want to specify Atlanta, but in general, the Phoenixes, the Las Vegases, the Southern Floridas, perhaps the Atlantis, are seeing less construction. So I think that's driving it. But one of the things that is really troubling, and I think, you know, we're going to have to come to grips with this, Americans sort of can't give up this idea that they want to live in a giant house. And it's not just in the suburbs. When I looked at the data, you know, the average house size 20, 30 years ago was about 1,000 square feet. Yeah, that's what I grew up in New Jersey. Single first floor of my parents' two-family house. Now the average house size is, you know, pushing 2,000, and some people estimate as many as 2,600 square feet. And that's not just in the suburbs. That's actually bigger condominiums. Condominiums are growing. You know, everybody needs that meeting room. Everybody needs that family room. Everybody needs that giant kitchen. Everyone, in a way, wants to live like a Kardashian or a Real Housewife. And I think people have to get over the fact that if they want affordable housing, if they want to live a better life, why consume so much space, much of what isn't used, downsize the size of the house? And I think that's what's happening. There's not enough affordable housing because people want a bigger and bigger house, and the house has grown. You know, it's more than doubled or tripled in size in the past generation. So I think getting used to resetting yourself and getting used to a little less space is a good thing for most people.
Elsewhere in your report, though, you mentioned another part of the landscape, which is that housing inventory is trending up. So as more expensive houses, maybe ones in that second tier, go unsold, won't some of the problem that we've just talked about resolve itself at least somewhat because they're going to have to bring the prices down in order to sell those houses?
Let's hope. You know, let's hope. And I think the other thing that's happening is some of that's being turned into rental. Rental is where the new construction is booming. Rental prices, unfortunately, are going up across the board in most markets. And I think it's, you know, the question of also, you know, maybe people just can't afford the down payment to get into the market these days. And maybe some of them had their credit ruined by the Great Recession. But my, you know, in the piece I mentioned that we're this great housing reset, you know, we under George W. Bush, we thought we were going to be a nation of owners. We were going to all own our own house. And, you know, that level of home ownership in America pushed up to almost 70%. Which is completely out of whack historically. You know, before the Great Depression, 40, 45% of Americans owned their own homes. And then we went on this long period where maybe 50 or 55%, only recently did we get above 60%. What I say in the piece is I think we've got to recalibrate. Not everyone should be an owner. Ownership is not a great investment for everyone. You know, smart financial people say if you're giving people investment advice, who would put all their eggs in one basket, a house that they can't sell, they call it illiquidity. So I think we're going to have to tilt back towards rental. And what I found in my own research is when you look at the metros that are the stodgiest, the ones that grow the slowest, the ones that are kind of sclerotic, they have between 70 and 80% of their residents owning a home. When you look at the metros that are the most dynamic, the Silicon Valleys, the San Franciscos, the Washington, D.C.s, the Bostons, I could go on, the Denvers, you're getting metros where we're below 60%, in some cases as few as 55%. That means between 40 and 45% of the market is renters. And what renting does is give you the ability to adjust your economy. You know, if you're not doing that well, you can shift your rental unit. If you're a young person looking to move up, you can move up in rentals. So I think what we're going to go through is a resetting of our housing market where we peaked at kind of 70% home ownership. And I think sooner or later, we're going to get down to about 60%. And who knows, over the course of the next generation, maybe as much as 55% of our population being owners, still a majority owners, but not the level of kind of over-ownership that we've seen in the past.
On the rental point, though, rents are going up. And I was looking at some data from the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, which said that in Georgia, you'd have to be making an average wage of some $17 plus per hour in order to afford a two-bedroom rental unit in Metro Atlanta. So are we seeing rents go out of reach as well for some folks? And what's happening to those people? I mean, if all of this data are correct, where are these folks?
A really great economist once said that America needs to get over its house passion. It needs to get back to deploying its resources on education, on technology, on knowledge and skills. And I think one of the mistakes we've made over the past couple of generations is the idea of the bigger house, that a bigger rental unit, that more space equals more status, a better life. And, you know, so many people say, you know, I've been, you know, house poor. My house is a sink. You know, I'm sinking all of my money pit. Not only a money pit, a time pit. I think we've got to get used to a different way of life. You know, there was another study just released this week that said the happiest people in the world, according to the study, are those who walk to work. And among the most miserable people in the world are those who drive to work. Living closer to where you work, walking to work, biking to work, being healthier, and those things make you much healthier. We know that from other research. If you walk or bike to work on average, you're much, much healthier than someone who drives to work alone. I think finding out that we can live in smaller space, that we can raise our families in smaller space, and look, you know, I'm the poster child for this. You know, we grew up in less than 1,000 square feet, a 3.5-4-room apartment in New Jersey, a kitchen, a living room, one bathroom, my mom's room, and my brother and I shared a room. Probably was 850 square feet. And we got along great, and we came out great. And I walked to school in this little suburban, working-class suburb. I think we got to get back to that. You know, not everybody needs to live in 1,000 square feet themselves. And so I think that's the lesson for folks in Atlanta. And you know, maybe Atlanta, because it's big and it's sprawled so much and it's so much new construction, people got used to those McMansion homes, got used to living in that big style, you know. But I think we've got to get used to, as a society, that we can have a better life if we deploy less of our resources as a family or as an economy on housing and more of it on our skills and on our experiences and, you know, being close to family and friends and going on vacations. I think that's what we've got to get to, and that's what's so troubling in these statistics. It seems like even though housing is becoming less affordable, we still want to get that next bigger house that's pushing our budgets. And I think it's time for a reset on that and to get back to living more within our means. And if that means living in a smaller home where we walk to work, so much the better.
One thing we are seeing in Atlanta, though, is that Atlanta itself and some of the smaller cities around it are trying to do exactly what you're talking about, put together walkable communities. But if the population gets denser in these cities that had seen people leaving them and suddenly they're coming back, are the cities going to be ready to provide the services that these folks are going to demand?
Yeah, you know, urbanists now have a name for this. They call this the Great Inversion. And it is true that particularly the baby boomers, whose kids have gone off and maybe whose kids moved back to an apartment in the city, they want to be back downtown. And, of course, the kids are heading back downtown because it's more fun. They don't have to drive. They can go out and have fun. They can go to bars. So we are seeing a different kind of pressure, you know, and we are seeing this sorting of our population where the more advantage. I actually built these maps in another post that I did for City Lab about a year ago of the class divide in Atlanta. And what we see in that, of course, there's wealthy suburbs, but also these wealthy urban neighborhoods and urban burbs, and the poor and the people working in the service industries and the working people being pushed into both concentrated poverty neighborhoods in the core, but way out into the suburban periphery, you know, commuting 45 minutes an hour, 2 hours to work. So I do think we are seeing this inversion, and what's happening is that some places that affordable housing used to be available in the urban core now becomes high-priced, you know, gentrified housing, and that puts an additional level of stress into the system. It's no longer you can move back to the city and get an afford as a young person, you know, as a musician, as an artist, and find affordable housing. That housing in the city, in upscale neighborhoods near Tramstedt in the city, is becoming more affordable, less affordable as well.
Is there an answer to this? And there's a bigger question. If we become more of a nation of renters, are we going to see a concentration of wealth, at least in terms of real estate, in the hands of a very few?
I think we are seeing that. I think if you look at a place like New York or San Francisco, if, you know, a working middle class, a professional person, even a knowledge worker, can't buy in anymore. If they miss the boat, so to speak, they are priced out. You look at a city like London, England, it's a city of the completely gilded, gated global rich. I think we are becoming that way. I think one of the reasons is we spent too much money on roads, and no longer, you know, as our metros like Atlanta, like Washington, like Boston have grown, we can no longer commute. Well, my parents moved to the quote-unquote suburbs of Newark where I was born. My dad had a 10-minute commute by car. It was the factory he worked in. Now our suburbs have sprawled. You know, it's an hour and a half, 2 hours in traffic. So I think we haven't built enough transit. We've got to get back to building transit. What we find is when transit comes in or on those old transit routes, you get these walkable suburbs, these mixed-use suburbs that are very desirable. And in the New York metropolitan area, that's where people are still finding some more affordable housing because the transit system works so well. For an individual level, though, I think it's a big mistake to overspend on housing. And to folks listening in, I just think, and we know this from research that we've done that others have done, if you want to be a saver, spend less on housing and put your money in good investments, stocks and bonds and the market. That's going to be your saving grace, your rainy day fund. That's going to give you a higher return than housing ever will. And the people who are going to go broke the people who are going to get in big trouble are those who overspend on housing, particularly big houses far afield where they need a car or two cars if it's a mom and a dad, or three or four cars if the kids are of age. Those are the people who drive themselves into financial ruin. So I think it's really, from an individual level, given this environment, is living within your means and not over-consuming housing. And, you know, if you have to live in a smaller space, closer to work, you can have a lot of better life that way than over-consuming housing, being financially stressed, and commuting a long distance.
It sounds as if, though, especially when you're talking about transit and some of the services that would have to be restructured, we're all going to end up paying for this at some level, perhaps in the form of higher taxes, if we want the kinds of walkable, livable communities that we're talking about.
The way I look at it is we had a growth model that worked well for the old factory economy. We taxed ourselves with property taxes and then state income taxes, so that we could build highway systems and we can build suburban towns. We would buy houses, fill them up with TVs and buy two cars and, you know, the air conditioning unit and a stereophonic system, and that would plow the drive the factories. That growth model is broken. We're no longer a factory economy. We're a knowledge economy. Now we have to think of a new growth model. That growth model is going to have to be denser, more concentrated. Instead of spending big bucks on infrastructure in the suburbs and big bucks on highway systems, we're going to have to use those same revenues to build transit and to build more clustered and denser development. So it may require more revenue, but I think it requires a new way of thinking about the way we build our communities, a new kind of growth model, and doing the spending we're doing very differently, away from the car-oriented, you know, auto-oriented suburb, and much more to a denser and then smaller, but ultimately happier way of life.
Richard Florida is the co-founder and editor-at-large of CityLab and a senior editor at The Atlantic, and his analysis is on the CityLab website. Richard Florida, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been great to be with you.